talk about now, I think I can, I think I can, reminds all of us, I'm sure, of the little engine that could. And the little engine that could, we all know the story. It brings home to us the fact that on a purely human level, God has equipped us physically and mentally to accomplish outstanding things. The yogis of India have proven that for the last 2,500 years. On a purely human level, without help from God, they are remarkable in their capacities. Some are old and some are young. They sit and squat, cross-legged, motionless, staring at their noses or staring at their navels. Some of them look squarely into the face of the sun, hour after hour, day after day, letting themselves slowly go blind. Some surround themselves with hot fires on days far hotter than this. Some of them walk barefoot on hot coals. Some lie naked for 35 or 40 years on beds of spikes. Some roll their bodies for thousands of miles to places of pilgrimage. Some bury themselves in the earth up to their necks and remain that way for years or for life. Some pass a wire through both of their cheeks, making it impossible to open the jaws, condemning themselves to living on liquids. Some clench their fists so strongly that their fingernails actually grow through the back of their hands. And some hold an arm or a leg up or out until it is withered and dead. Many of these people sit quietly in one position, perhaps for years, concentrating every thought in an effort to philosophically understand the nature of existence. On a purely human level, these things are possible because of the beings that God has allowed us to be. But when the Apostle Paul wrote in Philippians 4:13, "I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me," he gave us the corresponding Christian statement, which is exponentially more significant, and which acknowledges why you and I can do what we are capable of doing. Now, many times it is said that somebody has a wooden leg. You've heard that psychological statement, I think. A number of years ago, I read a book by Eric Byrne called Games People Play, in which he listed game after game relationally that people play with each other. One of the games was called Ain't It Awful? A subject is brought for discussion between two people, and they try to out-awful each other. About the price of living. You know what I had to pay for a loaf of bread? And you tell them. And then the other one counters, well, do you know what I had to pay for my new car? And you try to out-awfulize each other. Whoever has the most awful tale wins the game. The weather outside today is just awful. Well, that's nothing. My air conditioner won't work in my car. Well, that's nothing. Not only does my air conditioner not work, but the windows won't roll down. And whoever can be have the most awful story, they win the game. That's one of the games people play. Ain't it awful? Another game had to do with the PTA. That was the name of the game. Had to do with the school system in the community where you live. People get together and they talk about the school. Talk about how bad the teachers are, how awful the principal is. It's a game called PTA. Another game was called Why Don't You? Yes, But. In this game, somebody presents a problem they're having, and the other people in the game give the suggestion. Well, why don't you do this about your problem? Why don't you do that? And the person who initially postulated their problem says yes, but every time. Yes, that would seem to be a solution, but if I tried that, then this other awful thing would happen. Well, then why don't you do that? Well, yes, but if I tried that, then something else would happen, so I can't do that. And if you are able to fend off all the solutions to your problem, then you win the game. When somebody finally gives up and says, well, yes, I guess your situation is absolutely impossible, there's nothing you can do, then you win. Why don't you? Yes, but. Another game is called I Was Only Trying to Help, where you can go into a hurt motif when somebody does something. And say, I was only trying to help, when we've given them advice or tried to help out in some way. All kinds of games that people play with each other. We'll see some of those games played among us during these 2 weeks we're together. One of the games he mentioned was wooden leg. Wooden leg is so called because the person playing this game uses a handicap. Could be real, could be imagined. But they use this handicap in order to keep from being productive, as an excuse for not producing. And then when you're brought up on the charges of not producing, when somebody comes to you and confronts you about what you haven't done, you can always say, well, what do you expect from somebody with a wooden leg?
and you have a ready answer every time. Anything that keeps you from being productive can be your wooden leg. It could be an illness. It could be fear. It could be some bitterness or anxiety that you face. It could be your children. It could be your parents. Almost anything can be used as a wooden leg to keep you from accomplishing. It could be your job, or it could be the fact that you have no job. It could be your wife, or the fact that you have no wife. It could be your age. You're too old or you're too young. It could be a lack of education. You never had a chance. It could be your location. Any inability can be used as a wooden leg. Now, this is important, I believe, because one of the hallmarks of the Bible, Old Testament and New, is the idea of productivity. The first thing that God did, if we just pick up the Bible and begin reading it, the first attribute that he is known by is his creativity. In the beginning, God created, and we're not even out of the first verse of the Bible. If God created man in his image, man also must have some creative ability. God intends for us to be creating, creative beings. Be fruitful. In other words, be productive. God was placing man at this point in the garden to dress and to keep it. Before the curse came, man was still intended to be productive. Genesis 2:15. There was already something that man was designated to do. Let me stir up your minds by way of remembrance by just reading a couple passages without much comment, because I know we're familiar with these. Luke chapter 13, verse 6. He spake also this parable. A certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came and sought fruit thereon, and found none. Then said he unto the dresser of his vineyard, Behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this tree, and find none. Cut it down. Why cumbereth it the ground? And he answering said unto him, Lord, let it alone this year also, till I shall dig about it and dung it. And if it bear fruit, well. And if not, then after that thou shalt cut it down. Also, going along with that same thought, the 15th chapter of the book of John, beginning there in the first verse. I am the true vine, and my Father the husbandman. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away. And every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it, that it may bring forth more fruit. Now ye are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can ye, except ye abide in me. I am the vine, and ye are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me ye can do nothing. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch, and is withered, and men gather them, and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. You know, a number of years ago, when Abraham Maslow, who was a psychologist and researched in that area, when this great Jewish thinker looked at the needs of human beings and categorized them and placed them in a hierarchy, he designated that the length of time a person can do without something indicates just how much they need that thing. This was the question he would ask. Can you do without water longer than you can do without air? Yes, you can. All right, then that shows you need air more than you need water. You need them both, but you need air more than you need water. So those would be in the hierarchy. The top three, air, water, and food, he called the primary needs. But somewhere down the list, and I don't know what number it came in, somewhere down this list of needs, after the primary needs of physical life are met, is the drive to create, the need to produce, the need to order chaos in some way. So much is this a need of man that when we are not creating, when we're not producing, things don't work right for us. There was an experiment conducted down in Houston a few years ago where they tested every capacity that the people involved in the experiment had. Everything from manual dexterity to intellectual capacity, and they rated the individuals as to how strong they were in each of these areas. And then they looked at the strongest areas of capacity that each person had and found out that if in life, if people were not working in their strongest areas of capacity, if they were not producing there, they were not likely to be fulfilled as human beings. They needed to produce something. Almost anything would work as long as it was being produced. But when people were blocked, or thought they were blocked by external forces or some wooden leg of their own devising, they just didn't work right, and they could not be fulfilled. Now, if I were the devil, would I rather cause you to overtly and blatantly sin? Or, if I were the devil, would I rather just get you to do nothing? Just get you all anxious and bound up by some problem or perceived problem, so that you would sit and stare out the window for hours and not accomplish anything. Which would I rather do if I were the devil? Well, now, the devil might reason that if I can get you to sin overtly and blatantly, this might in you produce a sense of guilt. And this guilt might lead you to a godly sorrow, which would in turn take you to repentance, which would also then take you to justification and salvation. So I wouldn't want to do that. It might be a lot safer to make you afraid to do anything rather than make you overtly and blatantly sin. In the 25th chapter of the book of Matthew, about the 14th verse or so there, we have the very famous parable of the talents, and it's so famous I'm not going to read it at this time except just the beginning. The kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. As we heard this morning, everything from brain to toes and in between is delivered unto us by God. These are talents delivered unto us. And he gave unto one 5 talents, another 2, and another 1, to every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same, and made them 5 other talents. Something out of nothing. This is the miracle of creativity. Making something out of nothing. This concept of interest on money has always been fascinating to me. I remember as a little boy, I had a jar with about $6 worth of pennies in it, and I used to keep that in the linen closet at home, take it out and look at that every once in a while, maybe add a few pennies to it. But when I found out that if I let the bank keep that money and use it as they desire, they would actually give me more money back when I went to get it out, and it was guaranteed by the government, then I was amazed and fascinated by the concept of interest and even compound interest. That's the idea here of using or losing, using and gaining more. You take a builder that takes a lot and there's nothing out there but maybe a few trees and a little grass, and by taking materials in there and then rearranging them, he in a sense produces something out of nothing. On this lot where there was nothing before, he builds a beautiful house. That must be tremendously fulfilling. The man who had the 5 talents was faithful. He was trustworthy. He did what he was supposed to do. He was productive. Not by holding on to what he had, but by putting it at some use, by putting it even at risk. For as you know the story, that the 1 talent man was motivated, rather demotivated, by fear. I was afraid, he says. And that got him to the place where there was weeping and gnashing of teeth. Would he have been worse off if he had attempted to invest that money and exchange and had lost the talent? Would he have been any worse off? How could he have been any worse off? He wouldn't have been any worse off if he'd given it away. He wouldn't have been any worse off if he'd stolen that talent than to do the way he did with it. Now, the devil probably feels that he can accomplish more by getting people to do nothing in the church than to have them overtly sin. You know, there is such a thing as the legitimate fear of God. The psalmist in Psalm 19 called it clean. The fear of the Lord is clean. There is another kind of fear which makes you miserable. That's the 1 John 4 kind. Perfect love casteth out that kind of fear, because fear hath torment. It can really wear you down. The fear that torments you, though, is not the clean fear of God. The clean fear of God leads you to do right, to turn around if necessary, and leads you even to come boldly to the throne of grace. Clean fear, in other words, is productive, not the counterfeit fear, which immobilizes you and is an essentially selfish fear. Most of us do little about fear, but just suffer it. What we need to do when we're afraid is to do something worthwhile. And often it means to do the thing that we're afraid to do. Love casts out fear. This is the where he says, love not in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth, as Tom was talking about this morning. Anxiety, too much fear that's aimless, can become even a health problem for us. Do we hold on sometimes to confusion and anxiety and tension because they give us something to do rather than to produce? I think so. I've known people who specialized in being confused. They come to you and ask you questions, and you can sit there for hours and answer these questions. Now, do you understand? Yes, I think I've got it now. I think I finally understand. I've never seen it this way before. And then you hear them talking to somebody else. I'm just so confused about this subject. You know, as long as you're confused, you've got an excuse for doing nothing. I don't know what to do. I'm too confused. We can hold on to confusion as a substitute for creating and accomplishing something. We just need to break loose and do. Even a hobby is better than nothing, especially a creative hobby. You were made to be a builder. And when you're doing nothing but just idling your engine, you're not being fulfilled. You know, there are people, I've known several people, who all their life wanted to paint on canvas, but somehow never did. Never came to the place where they did that. What's stopping a person? People learn to paint. This is how it's done. Why sit and wish? Winston Churchill, one time, under great anxiety, was sitting out in his front yard. And he had this canvas in front of him. He'd never painted anything in his life. Always wanted to be a painter. He's just sitting there looking at this canvas with the paints in front of him. Can't get started. His neighbor, Hazel Lavery, pulled up in her car, walked over to him, took some of his paint and splashed it on the canvas and said, "Now you're already started." And Winston Churchill painted from that time on, almost till his dying day. Became a very interesting painter. But it took something, somebody, to break the spell and get him started. If you ever listen to somebody play a guitar and say, "Boy, I wish I could play a guitar like that." Next time you say that, catch yourself in what you're really saying, because you probably don't wish it enough to actually do it, do you? You don't want to do the work that it would take to get to play the guitar like that. I have a friend who says we always do our first priority. And I'd like to think for you to think about that statement pretty hard before you disagree with it too much. There is a sense, at least, in which we always do our first priority. Think about that. We have talent. I wouldn't be surprised if in this room right now there was somebody who had the ability, the raw talent, to be a concert pianist if you had chosen to work on that. I'm not saying you should or shouldn't. That isn't the point. But we have a tremendous amount of ability. Often, we just don't want to do the work to fulfill a certain ability. We ought to be honest about that, at least. Let's not sit and say, "I wish I could do this," or "I wish I could do that." Why aren't you? That's a pretty feeble, diluted wish, usually. It's not wanting it bad enough. Why aren't you if you wish you could? The answer is usually very simple. We just didn't want to do the work. You just don't often know what you can do through Christ who strengtheneth you until you force yourself. Jesus said, "Herein is my Father glorified, if you bear much fruit," if you're highly productive. Do not let yourself take your fulfillment away from you. Don't give up your fulfillment for a wooden leg. You know, it has seemed to me through the years that many times people who have real wooden legs, in other words, real true disabilities or handicaps, often are more productive than those of us who have these false wooden legs that we carry around. Did you ever notice that? Did you read in the paper the other day or see on TV about that guy in a wheelchair sitting at a swimming pool, and there's a little child drowning out in the swimming pool? This guy in the wheelchair rolls over to the edge of the pool, lunges himself into the pool, and rescued that child. Did you see that? It's an amazing thing for me to think about. It's an inspirational example of doing something. What was that was said this morning? You know you can, and therefore you must. That's a good example. He knew he could do that, even though a person in a wheelchair wouldn't have been expected to do it. Last Lord's Day, I was in a place. There was a young man there in the congregation, 17 years of age. This young 17-year-old boy is legally blind. But yet, on that Sunday morning, he stood up before the congregation and he read the Bible to the congregation. He has to put the Bible right up like this. You talk about having your nose in a book. He had it. You're right up like this. He has to lean to the side so his voice can get to the microphone. But he read from the Word of God to the assembled congregation. Later that day, he also led a song or two. Has to get his nose right in the book to even see it. But he did it. I wonder if that young man knows how tremendously inspiring that example is for the rest of us. He does what he can. What a wonderful thing this is. Maybe you and I who are not disabled are afraid of losing something. Maybe people who already have lost a lot and still see that life is pretty good aren't afraid to take a risk and pull out the stops and do what they can. Often it seems that way to me. They don't want to lose more than they've already lost through self-pity or fear or bitterness. And so they go ahead and do what they can. Sometimes you and I, who are not disabled, may give up more than they have lost because of our wooden legs. We must sometimes be tragic figures. In their eyes, here they are disabled and relatively productive and happy, and here we are whole and often unproductive and unhappy. When your wooden leg starts acting up, remember to turn away from it and go to work and create something. Create something worthwhile. Be productive. This changes our life when we set a worthy goal and go after it. The ancient Orientals used to have a saying that went like this: every hair makes its shadow on the ground. That's you or that's me. We're just a hair, but we have an influence. Every ant may collapse an embankment, they said. When a dead tree falls, they said, the woodpecker's share in its loss. Everybody can contribute something substantial to the upbuilding of the kingdom of God on earth. And everybody has an influence, like in Longfellow's poem. I shot an arrow into the air, it fell to earth, I knew not where, for so swiftly it flew, the sight could not follow in its flight. I breathed a song into the air, it fell to earth, I knew not where, for who hath sight so keen and strong that it can follow the flight of song? And then he said, long, long afterward, in an oak, I found the arrow still unbroke, and the song from beginning to end, I found again in the heart of a friend. Do something. Be productive. Speak a good word. It has its influence in life. A lot of people think if they can't do something that they think is major, they just won't do anything at all. The story is told of a little man about 5 feet 2 inches tall. He went up to a great big fellow, 6 feet 6 inches tall, and he said, you know, if I were as big as you are, I'd go out of the woods and I'd find the biggest bear I could find and I'd tear him to pieces. The big guy looked down at him and said, well, you know, there's a lot of little bears out in them there woods too. And of course there are. I'm only one, but I am one. I can't do everything, but I can do something. Why should I let what I cannot do keep me from doing what I can do? Not only is that true, but by combining our efforts in the faith, we can do more than the two of us could do apart. Remember what Moses said by the inspiration of God to the children of Israel very early, speaking of their enemies, that one of you shall put 1,000 to flight, but two of you shall put 10,000 to flight? That's an exponential change. Two together may do a lot more than two apart. A lot of times people say, well, yes, I could. I've got the capacity, but I just don't have the time. Well, there may be some truth in that. But usually, that statement just means that I don't want to. I'd rather not. I don't have the time unless it's put to, I don't have the time to do it this week, so I'll do it next week. Unless that's augmented with something else, it usually means something other than really not having the time. Spurgeon used to use this example, and I like this example. He said, take a large box and place in this big box as many cannonballs as it'll hold. Now it's full, after a fashion. But you can then take several bags of marbles and pour them down over those cannonballs, and they'll fit in just fine, packed between the spaces of the larger globes. And now the box is full. But now you can take a bunch of shotgun shot and pour that down over it, and it will sink down in between the marbles and the cannonballs. And you can take several pounds of sand and pour it on top of that, and it fits down in there very well. And now the box is full. But then you take several pitchers of water, and you can still pour that into the box. And the point is that we all have little fragments of time which are often wasted. Where there's no space for something big, there may be space for something little in your life. And where the little can't enter in, maybe the less can find its way in. Where the less is shut out, maybe the least of all can be done. A simple phone call, perhaps. Where we say that our time is fully occupied, ordinarily there are stray moments and occasional intervals and snatches where really a great amount of usefulness can be done in the course of the months and the years that make up your life. If we want to, we can do. It's not, I think I can. Paul didn't say, I think I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me. He said, I can. And we can too. We can do. And we'd better. The Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes said, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. And Jesus said, I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. We've already seen that work was a part of God's plan for man from the very beginning. God placed man in the Garden of Eden to dress and to keep it. Yes, work was changed somewhat and made more difficult by the curse and the fall. But work has always been a part of God's plan. And work is the best thing that has ever happened to us outside of Jesus. It's wonderful that God does have work for us to do. I don't know how a lazy man would have been treated under the Old Testament regime, because we don't have that information. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work was said not to make the Jews work 6 days, but to keep them from working seven. They were a pretty industrious people. So I don't know how they would have been treated, but we do know that there were slothful people, because Solomon went by the field of the slothful. We know that there were some. I just don't know what happened to their families. I don't know if anybody came to their rescue or how that worked. There was such a mindset in their society that ordinarily people were willing to work long and hard and not think too much about it. Very unlike our world today. We ought not let our environment and the people around us dictate our thinking about how much or what kind of work we ought to do. Rather, we should let the capacities that God has built into us determine just how much we can do. Remembering the biblical injunctions, always abounding in the work of the Lord, 1 Corinthians 15:58, and abound to every good work, 2 Corinthians 9:15. The next time you think, well, I'm just not up to this, I just can't do this, is that true? Sometimes we need to be a little hard on ourselves, perhaps. And when life does not buffet us, we need to buffet ourselves. Are we ready to say to the Father in the last day, well, I just couldn't do it because of the way I was conditioned by the way society was? You didn't expect a lot more from me than you did of the people around me, did you? You didn't want me to lose sleep. That isn't good for me. You didn't want me to strain my eyes. You didn't want me to put myself out, surely. How's God going to answer those kinds of questions? It may be true that even our physical condition makes some difference to the way God views and will judge. If I have a physical condition that I could remedy in some way that would make me more effective in the service of Christ, then it seems to me I'm duty-bound to do that. I might even need to exercise a little bit physically for the Lord. Thessalonica was a Roman colony where there were a group of people, soldiers who had been mustered out of the army and put on the government payroll, who got into the habit of not working. And some of these people came into the church, and Paul dealt with that. Study to be quiet, do your own business, work with your hands, he said. And if any will not work, then he should not eat. You know, even Paul sometimes stopped and took time to make tents. This is purely speculation. I have no basis for it at all. Perhaps I ought not even to say it. I'll just say it in a sentence and let it go. Personally, I believe that if we could see one of those tents that Paul made, it would have been very beautifully and very well done. That's the kind of man I believe the Apostle Paul was. Doing, as he said, Colossians 3:23, whatsoever you do in word or deed, do it heartily, as unto the Lord and not to men. Surely he made his tents heartily as well. One of my elders asked the question one time, if you don't have time to do it right the first time, when are you going to have time to do it over? And that's an excellent question to keep in mind when we're working. I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. Work is as natural a man as breathing. Much better to wear out than to rust out. Edison said, there's no substitute for hard work. He said, the genius is 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. Minchner said that if he had made a mistake by working too hard, at least it was a mistake in the right direction. And that's exactly the way I believe every Christian should feel about life. If you're going to make a mistake, make it in the direction of working too hard. John Greenleaf Whittier was the man who said this, of all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest these, it might have been. Wouldn't it be awful to come down to the end of this fast-passing life and have that said as a synopsis of what you had accomplished? It might have been. He had the potential. He had the opportunity. His appearance was good. His people skills were fine. But somehow, there was something in him that just would not get going. He didn't have the confidence that comes from faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. He didn't have the desire, whatever it was. He just never got himself in gear. Julius Caesar is the man who, after he had conquered an important province, said in Latin, and of course the Latin V's are pronounced as W's, "Winnie, witty, wicky, I came, I saw, I conquered." There was a misunderstanding of that that's on the board, said by somebody who didn't know Latin V's were pronounced like W's. "Vinny, vitty, velcro, I came, I saw, I stuck with it."